I wanted to thank everyone who came on Friday night to the memorial gathering that we had for Jeff Jones. And it was one of those nights where I was so proud of our community. It was just one of those amazing nights. When you stop to think about in the small community that we have, the amount of intelligent articulation and the courage to go where your emotions take you and to speak about those things and to be unafraid to just, you know, be exactly who you are. And also the talent in the room. We had one young man recite poetry, perform poetry, and there was just so much going on. But I was just so proud that, you know, in the midst of all the hurting and all the questions and all the things that have been going on for the last 3 weeks, that we could assemble that way and then just facilitate healing in such a beautiful, beautiful way. So it was great. And for those of you who weren't here, but we felt the prayers and the thoughts going up, and so it was just a great time. And, you know, there are lots of questions we have been asking. And to kind of circle back around to where we were 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, when we were going through our red letter study and coming back into that and trying to pick up where we left those threads, it's a little bit difficult, and I'm kind of pulling and trying to get back into that mode. But as I was thinking about it last night, it makes perfect sense. And it ties together in a very interesting way, because we're sitting here in the middle of Matthew 5, which is the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And what Jesus is doing is educating us in a really, really impactful and even outrageous way. He's trying to get us to see something that is so radically different than what we normally see in life, and without which we can't experience kingdom. We cannot experience kingdom if we don't get over this particular hump, this particular way of thinking. And that's really what's at issue here. Now, just a quick recap. In the first part of the Sermon on the Mount, he gives us the Beatitudes, which are the picture of the finished product. It's that portrait of what a person looks like who is actually living in kingdom. The humility, the perseverance, the joy with which we can enter into each other's emotions and feelings and situations to be perfectly present is this person who is living in kingdom. And I suppose we have to understand that by kingdom we don't mean heaven, we mean the quality of life right here, right now, that's available to us when we can enter into the presence of God's Spirit in each other. From the Beatitudes, he moves into the effects that this person has on the community around them. He calls it salt and light. And we talked about how important salt was to the ancient world before refrigeration and before antibiotics. Salt was life itself. And so someone who is living in kingdom is life itself, preserves life, you know, fertilizes new life and adds zest to the life that is there in the community because of who they are, because of their ability to be present. And light, of course, this illumination, this not just understanding in a cognitive way, but the ability to make order in our lives out of the chaos of the darkness, to be able to find harmony and peace and connection. This kingdom person brings that into the community as well. And then Jesus makes a transition from there and starts talking about law, because law is the thing that can keep us from everything he was talking about. If we understand that our connection with God is primarily legal, there's a code, there's a law we have to follow, and our primary connection with God is simply obedience, Jesus says we will never enter the kingdom if all we do is obey, if all we do is follow rules. He says, I didn't come to abolish the law, but I came to fulfill it. And he came to fulfill it in a specific way. And the whole rest of this chapter, really the whole rest of the Sermon on the Mount, is talking about how this law is fulfilled in a way that the people didn't understand, because their religious leaders, their rabbis, had gone so ultra-legalistic, had taken the law and refined it to such a point that nobody could understand it, let alone follow it anymore, which gave them their power over the people, because they had to come to the rabbis to find out what was lawful, what was not, what was clean, what was not, how they could comply, how they could get back into community. And Jesus is saying, that's not it. Take a look in your bulletins, or Matthew 5:17. or up on the screens. Do not think that I came to abolish the law of the prophets. I didn't come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly, I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. And we talked about how pass away there in Aramaic, in the language that Jesus actually spoke, doesn't talk about just ending. It's crossing a boundary. It's going past a threshold or past a limit. And so literally what he's saying there, until heaven and earth cross their boundaries and merge and become one, the law is in force. Because what's the purpose of the law? The purpose of the law is to bring unity where there is none, to preserve life where life is at risk. In the group setting, that's the highest good. In the group setting, to preserve the life of the community, to ensure that future generations can live and grow and thrive, to bring families and bring the entire nation together as one, that's the purpose of the law. As long as we have division, we will need the law. But as soon as heaven and earth pass away, as soon as they merge into one, like training wheels on a bike, it can go away. It's no longer needed. But until that point, not the smallest stroke, not the smallest letter will pass away. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Not in terms of mere obedience, but in something else that Jesus has in mind. And at Matthew 5:20, he gives it to us straight out. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. The scribes and the Pharisees were masters at obedience, masters at defining every little last bit of the law and following it and requiring others to do so. Unless we exceed obedience, move past it, until the law becomes written on our hearts. And from the inside out, instead of the outside in, we understand what this is all about. Then Jesus says, you are living a life, and God loves you and accepts you, but you aren't going to experience what that life means. And Jesus said, I came to bring life, but life abundantly. Not just grinding it out, not just coping. You know, I remember someone talking about Christian coping. Those two words should never be put together. We're not here to cope. We're not here to survive. We're here to thrive. We're here to live abundantly. That is not going to happen if you're merely following rules. Because the reason you follow rules is to avoid punishment. And if all you're doing is avoiding punishment, you're living in fear. And if you're living in fear, you will never experience the love that Jesus says his Father has for each one of us. Love that is absolutely unconditional. Absolutely without prerequisite. He loves us because we're sitting here breathing and for no other reason. And as long as we're trying to live up to some sort of standard, trying to avoid some type of punishment, we'll never know what that means and we'll never feel the transformation that it can bring. So, with that purpose in mind, we have to start looking at specific things, because I can say these things and they sound good, at least I hope they do. And I can see heads going up and down like, okay, I can agree with that. But when it gets down to the specifics, how quickly do we fall back on what we know? How quickly do we fall back on the training of our youth and what we've experienced all our lives just in the way the world works? And I know some of you have been through this exercise with me before, but bear with me. And even if you have, listen again, because we have to keep coming back to it. We have to keep jolting ourselves to understand how radical this really is. We've all been taught to follow rules. We've all been taught. I grew up Catholic. It was all about works. It was all about the rules. Those of you who grew up in other traditions, maybe even outside Christianity, there's still the law. There's still rules that have to be followed. We learned early on that we got rewarded when we did certain things according to people's rules and we didn't otherwise. We were accepted when we followed rules and we weren't otherwise. And so we learned to follow these rules. And we learned to follow them completely, sometimes blindly, because we have to, because the alternative is too terrible to think about. But let's think about it for a minute. Is lying always wrong? Is it always wrong to lie? No. Someone says no. But you know what? When we ask that question, when I ask that question, most often the knee-jerk reaction is, yeah, it is. It says right there in the Ten Commandments, don't bear false witness. Not supposed to lie. But what is the purpose of the rule? It's not just to banish false sayings. It's to preserve life and to promote unity and oneness. All right? So the classic example, you're a German in 1940s Germany. You got Jews in the attic and the Gestapo's at your door. Do you have any Jews here? What do you say? What is the right thing to do? Now, it's not the lawful thing to do. It's the right thing to do. To lie is to preserve life in that situation. To lie is to promote unity in that situation. To lie is to prevent the aggressor from harming the innocent in that situation. It's still unlawful. And if they find out, you're in big trouble under the law. But you know in that situation what the right thing to do is. Honey, does this dress make me look fat? What's the right thing to do? From the sublime to the ridiculous, right? But you get the idea. Is stealing always wrong? Of course it is. Is stealing always wrong if you have to feed your family? If you've tried everything else? The whole premise of La Miserable, right? Jean Valjean steals a loaf of bread to feed his family and the whole rest of the movie ensues, or the play or whatever, the book. If it is the purpose to preserve life, then we are compelled to break the rules. We must break the rules. Right? Is killing always wrong? Well, not in defense of life and not in protection of the innocent. Of course not. We know that. Our laws even reflect that. There's a difference between killing and murder. We understand that. But it gets more difficult as we go down the road. Is suicide always wrong? Well, I'll tell you, growing up Catholic, suicide was a one-way trip to hell. No doubt about it. You know, there was no ifs, ands, or buts. Suicide was an unforgivable sin. But is suicide, or the intent of suicide, always to end life? I mean, maybe an easy one, maybe one that's not quite on point, but it'll get the ball rolling. The soldier that falls on a grenade to protect the rest of his platoon. That's suicide technically, but it's not his intent. His intent is to shield his buddies from the blast, and he kills himself in the process. There is a right to life law in Oregon. And a few years ago, I read an article about a man up there who was suffering from bone cancer, had maybe 6 months left to go. And he's laid up in the hospital. He was not going to get out of that hospital until the day he dies. And if you know anything about bone cancer, it's the most painful type of cancer that there is. And there's no real coming back from it when it's metastasized and gotten into the bones. And he was going to watch his family have to take care of him, to change his diapers when he became incontinent, to suffer every moment of his pain with them, or to be so drugged out that he didn't even know where he was, and to watch his family's life savings be chipped away at and leached out from under them because of the end-of-life expenses, medical expenses that he would incur through that last period of time. And so under Oregon law, if you can get three doctors to sign off, you can get a secobarbital mix, and it can be right there on your nightstand, and you can take it any time that you want. Is that right? Is it a good law? Is it a moral law? Is it moral for him to do it? What's the duties of his family to talk him out of it? He said in the article that he didn't even know if he would use it, but just having it there gave him some comfort. Just knowing he had a little bit of control, something he could do if it just all got to be too much. And if he did take that mixture, was his intent to end his life? Of course not. With everything in him, he wanted to live. It would be to protect his family and maybe protect himself from the pain, of course, and the indignity of what he was going to go through. Is that wrong? And even someone who has seemingly none of those situations going on in their life and they still kill themselves, at that moment, what is it they really intend to do? Is it just because they can't stand the pain anymore And this is a way out for them. And if we can understand their situation, if we can have compassion, if we can say, yeah, maybe that isn't wrong or unforgivable, don't we think this Father in heaven who loves us with this absolute, unconditional love can feel something of the same? See, sometimes it seems that we take God's justice to such an extreme that he becomes slave to his own nature, slave to his own justice, as if he cannot violate the attributes that he set for himself. I don't know, how does that work? If God is love, then we have to look at things a little bit differently. This is what Jesus is trying to do for us. He's trying to get us to take a look at things differently. And the technique that he uses, and you're going to see a formula here, they're called the six great antitheses that are going to be happening here, starting at Matthew 5:21. And there's a formula. You have heard it said of old, and then he states the Old Testament law or the Old Testament tradition or the tradition that has been handed down for centuries to the Jews. But I'm going to tell you something different. And he flips back and forth between the two. And when he's doing that, this rule, this law of old that he's going to lay out, exists under the law as a macro instrument. It's something that the group needs in order to survive. But then he says, but I'm going to tell you something different. And he's going to code shift us over to the micro, to a personal relationship. Because that's where kingdom lives. Kingdom is not a macro phenomenon. Kingdom is what happens in our hearts. And so there's a chart on your bulletins that maybe will help to understand the difference between these two. Because if we can't figure out the difference between macro and micro and what's at stake here, we're lost. In macro, in a group, three or more, the highest good is justice. Those of you who have kids or have taken care of kids know, two kids operate one way. You add the third kid, the whole dynamic changes, right? Completely different. Now it's got to be fairness to the nth degree for those kids to get along. Everything has to be fair. Without fairness, without justice, without the scales balancing exactly in the group ceases to exist. Justice is the highest good. The Old Testament is written from the point of view of the nation of Israel. It is a macro book. The Jews never prayed for themselves alone. They always prayed for all of the nation of Israel. It's the group, it's the community that is the focus. And so justice is the highest good. It's reflected in the way the book reads, the way it was written. The New Testament is a micro book. It focuses on the one-on-one relationship between us and our God, between us and another person. In the micro, the highest good is not justice. It's mercy and compassion. We have to understand this. You know, you're never going to hear politics from me up here, ever. But I'm going to use a political... it's not an analogy. I'm just going to use a political situation here to see if we can kind of get this driven home to us. This is foundational. We have a difference between liberals and conservatives in our country, right? It has nothing to do with Republican and Democrat or politics. Just think about liberals and conservatives. The highest good for liberals generally as a group is compassion and mercy. They want to be compassionate to those who do not have. They want to make sure that income gets redistributed to those people because they don't have anything. And they see an evil in our country when that distribution has not taken place. Conservatives, on the other hand, their highest good, stated, and you'll hear it over and over again, is justice. It's the rule of law. It's being a nation of laws that are followed and are used to be able to ensure the cohesiveness of the group. But here's the rub. In the group, the highest good is justice. If you try to legislate mercy and compassion, what you get is less justice. And without justice, the group falls apart. On the other hand, if you take justice into your micro relationships, your one-on-one relationships, then you become intolerant. You become unfeeling. Because in a micro relationship, something much more than balancing the scales is required. It requires everything that is in us. We need to be able to move back and forth between those two values, to realize that in the group, the justice is the highest good, without which we lose everything. But in the micro, Jesus says, If you can't exceed mere obedience, if you can't exceed the following of rules and the law, you will never enter the kingdom. You will never get there. In our daily lives, this is what we go through. We need to realize that we need to code shifts as individuals. We need to move between mercy and justice and compassion in the ways that are appropriate to what we're dealing with, whether it's the group or the individual. And this is what Jesus is going to try to take us through. So when you look at this, between the micro and the macro, the context for macro is community and for micro is personal. The emphasis for macro is the law. Has to be. And the emphasis for the micro is ethics. And not just ethics generally, but situational ethics. Like we just talked about. Lying isn't always wrong. It depends on the situation. And stealing and killing. It's a situational ethics that needs to be taking place here in the micro. The goal of the macro is justice. The goal of the micro is mercy. The means by which that's obtained in the macro is obedience to the law. But in the micro, it's love. It's going beyond just what is required. And the result of the macro is conformance. That's what we want. We want the group to conform so that it can survive, so that there is a predictable way of doing things. You need to conform to those traffic lights at the intersection if you want to survive. Conformance, right? Highest good. But in the micro, it's transformance. The macro causes us to conform from the outside in. Jesus says that we need to transform from the inside out. We need to know the difference between these two so we can negotiate them. All right? So now Jesus is going to start with these antitheses. He's going to start to illustrate. We're only going to do the first one today, and then we'll pick up later on. But the idea here is, let's just read it. Matthew 5:21. You have heard that the ancestors were told, or in other translations, you have heard of old that it was said, you shall not commit murder. And whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. Now in all caps there, he's quoting directly the Old Testament law, right out of the Decalogue, right out of the Ten Commandments. And notice that it's murder and not kill. There are two different Hebrew words there. Ratzak means to murder. Harag means to kill. The word is ratzak. Thou shalt not murder. Because they understood and we understand that sometimes you do need to kill. But murder is something completely different. Premeditated, lying in wait, killing someone. That is what is prescribed here. Proscribed, not prescribed. Whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. The court there is one of these lower courts that existed in all of the small towns in Judea. 7-member tribunals that had the authority over capital cases. And so a person would be brought who was suspected of murder before the court with 2 or 3 witnesses. Had to have at least 2 and preferably 3. And on the basis of the witnesses, the court would decide. And if the person was found guilty, they would be sentenced to death by stoning. And they would be taken to a public place. And the witnesses were the ones who cast the first stones. And then the rest of the community would follow on. Yeah. The capital offense of murder was one that could not be offset with a fine, with a monetary fine. When we talk a little bit later about the lex talionis with the retribution, you'll find that even though it says an eye for an eye, typically that wasn't done. You know, if you knock someone's eye out, they didn't take your eye out, that didn't help them any. What you would do would you calculate the worth of the person with 2 eyes and the worth of the person with 1 eye, and then they would have to pay the difference. But you couldn't do that with murder. You could, but then the honor and shame society rules kicked in. And if someone killed someone from another family, then the blood retribution kicked in. And so this was something that had to be managed. And it was very complex. But what Jesus is saying here is that you've heard it of old that you shall not murder. You know all of those rules, all these things that are in your culture. But I want to say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Everyone who's angry with his brother is guilty before the court. Same word there. Just as if anger in your heart were the same as physically committing murder. If you're just angry, how in the world does that work? Could those two possibly be the same? And then he ups the ante. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go to the fiery hell. How in the world does this work? What kind of standard is Jesus trying to hold us to? Seriously? Anger towards someone, and I'm guilty before the court? Well, lock us all up, right? What are you going to do with that? And then, this word that he used here, raka, good for nothing. It meant, you know, worthless. It meant something, you know, just someone who was just completely unusable. And it was a spoken insult. So it escalates, right, from the anger to actually speaking the word. And then the last word there, translated as you fool, lela, was actually it was like an ultimate insult in that language. It doesn't sound like much in ours, but in their language, to be called completely worthless, an imbecile, a coward is the way it's translated in the Aramaic Peshitta. To call someone that, them's fighting words, it guarantees a physical response. There is a teaching technique that the rabbis used called kalvei chomer, and basically it means light and heavy. And the idea is if something is true in the light instance, then it's even more true in the heavy instance. So whenever Jesus says something like, you know, if you love your children, how much more will your Father in heaven love you? Kalvei chomer. Okay, if it's true in the light instance, true in the heavy instance. But it could also be used to say, when something is small, nip it in the bud before it goes any further, because it's much easier to control in the small instance than the light instance. This is what Jesus is doing. But what is he illustrating? He's illustrating that if all we do is obey, we never enter kingdom. If all we do is relate to people in the group, in the abstract, then we will never be able to relate to them one-on-one. And kingdom always lives in the one-on-one, between us and our God, between us and another person. It's not enough not to commit murder. You're safe under the law. You think you're doing fine. I didn't kill him. But as soon as you're angry with someone, you've already compromised the relationship. In recovery, we know that as soon as the resentment sets in, as soon as the bitterness sets in, we are a relapse in progress, because it already has compromised everything about us, our attitude, our way of dealing with people. And when we let that sit and fester, then get to the point where we're actually speaking out what we feel about a person, now we've compromised the relationship from their point of view, if they didn't already figure it out that we were upset. And when we give them the ultimate insult that then incites violence, we're off to the races. Jesus is trying to teach us how to live relationally, not legally. We know how to do legal. He wants to teach us how to do relational. He wants to teach us to go beyond everything that we think we need to do in order to be safe, in order to be right. And then he gives us a couple of examples beyond that. At verse 23, therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. What's he telling us? You know? We think because we come to church, we think because we say our prayers, we think because we do, you know, baptism and all the things that we do religiously, we follow everything that our tenets of faith tell us to do, we're good with God. We're going to be fine. But if our relationships are not, then what's the point? All of that stuff, all of that religiosity is dedicated and designed to do one thing. That's to make our relationships right, to make our relationships tight, to allow us to be able to connect and live and thrive with each other in beautiful relationship. If it's not doing its job, throw it out. It's absolutely meaningless. Go, reconcile, make your relationships right. It's the most religious thing you can do. It's the most spiritual thing you can do, is to make your relationships right. Then come back. And if you want to kill the bird, kill the bird. You know, it's okay. But the relationships are the primary thing. It's what this is all about. Kingdom cannot be experienced outside of relationship. And then at verse 25, make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way. That's on the way to the court, right? So that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid the last cent. Any of you who have had to go to court, you probably will agree with this statement. As soon as you walk into the courtroom, everyone loses, except the lawyers. We don't find kingdom in a courtroom. We find adversity. We find division in a courtroom. You know, sometimes when couples are going through a divorce and they're trying to settle, you know, all of the splitting of property and children and all the mess that happens, they think they need the court to referee all that. And it's like, no. If you and your spouse can agree on things, then you don't need the court to get involved at all. Of course, I suppose if you and your spouse could agree on things, you wouldn't be getting divorced in the first place. You know? The court only needs to get involved when we can't work things out on our own. So what is Jesus saying? Don't try to live your relationships in the macro. Don't take them to the court. Because you are going to be exacted on that standard and you will live or die by that sword. It's not where you want to go. Make friends on the way with your opponent. Find him. Talk to him. Work it out. Because not only will you work out probably a better settlement than you'll get at the court, but you'll have a friend at the end of all of that and not an enemy for life. What this is about learning to live in relationship. We won't do it by merely following rules. Yes, we need to follow rules. That's the first step. Not stepping on each other's toes. But to move past that, to understand what this is all about, changes everything. Changes everything. What is this all going to do for us? How is this going to change anything? You know, whenever we go back and we pull things apart and we kind of parse them through the Hebrew lens, I always know we got to bring it right back to something that we can use as soon as we walk out that door. If we can't get it that one-to-one, we're going to lose everything here. So what does this do for us? The first thing is, it's telling us that Jesus is not trying to hold us to an impossible standard. One of the problems the church has had with the Sermon on the Mount, it all sounds so impossible. Here he's saying that an angry thought and murder are the same thing. In the next, he's going to say that looking lustfully at a woman and adultery are the same thing. What? He's going to tell us to pull out an eye and cut off a hand if it leads us into sin. He's going to tell us to go the second mile and turn the other cheek. All these crazy things that sound ethically and morally wrong. But what we learn is he's not holding us to an impossible standard. He's trying to get us to shift context, to find a new worldview that includes this notion of perfect love in the micro, moving from legal to relational, from fear to love. If we can do that, everything opens up. Everything else can be added. The second thing, he's showing us where to put the red X over the treasure on the treasure map. If we think that we are going to find kingdom, if we think we are going to find the abundant life that Jesus has for us by simply following rules, by going to the letter, by doing it better than anybody has ever done it before, we're just digging holes. But if we can move that X to where the treasure actually lies, our digging is going to get us somewhere. The work that we do is taking us right to the center of God's love. We need to know where to dig, or we're just digging holes. Remember the movie? Holes, digging holes. I love that song they had. And the third thing is, it can bring clarity to us. Bring clarity to our thoughts and bring clarity to our actions. If it was difficult for you to understand whether you could lie or cheat or steal, this is a way for you to get clarity to your thinking. To understand, yes, under the right circumstances, absolutely, I could do that if I have to. I could go there. A few years ago, I was speaking at another church, and at the end, two women came up to me. And they were arm in arm, and it was obvious that one was supporting the other, just by body language, just watching them walk up to me. You know, one was kind of leaning in and obviously distraught. And when they came up to me, the one who was standing straight was the one who was doing the talking. And she said, "We just need to talk to you for a minute. Maybe you can give us a little help here." And it turns out that the other woman had a friend who had married a Jewish man and converted to Judaism in her marriage and had just committed suicide. And she could barely get the story out. She was so choked up. She was just so distraught over the whole thing. Because in her mind, because of the rules that she grew up with, first of all, this woman converted from Christianity to Judaism, strike one, and then she killed herself, strike three. And what she wanted to know was, would God still accept her? Could she still be in heaven if she had gone through that? How would you answer that question? What would you say? If you're coming from a legal understanding of how our God works, it forces you to an answer that reinforces the agony and the pain. Now, if that's the right answer, so be it. But if you can make this code shift, if you can move from the macro to the micro, from fear to love, from legal to relational, you can start to understand things in a very different way. And with all your heart, with everything that's in you, you can look straight into that woman's eyes and you can tell her what I told her. Absolutely, she is accepted. Absolutely, she's with God as long as she wants to be. There is no power on heaven, in heaven or on earth that will keep us from the love of our God if that's what we desire. Suicide is not the unforgivable sin. Judaism is not the unforgivable sin. Lying, stealing, and everything else that we can do is not unforgivable. Jesus is showing us with everything in him, and he's going to go on with his whole ministry to try to get us through this one understanding. Our God is a rule breaker. Our God is willing to break the rules in our favor. God's love is not just. It's just perfect. God is willing to unbalance the scales of justice in our favor. He will give us what we don't deserve because we are his children and he loves us. And if we want to be with him, there is nothing that can keep us from being there. That's our God. That's who Jesus is trying to show us. We have to do some mental and heart gymnastics to finally start to understand how such a thing could be so, because it just seems too good to be true. Let's pray. Father, you are too good to be true. It doesn't compute. Help us to deal with the difficult things in our minds that keep our hearts from being free enough to embrace all that you are and all that you offer us. Whatever we're clinging to, whatever security we feel we still need, give us the strength and the courage to let go. Just release our grip. Let it fall. And trust that your Spirit is sufficient for this moment to take us exactly where we need to go in you. We want to move to the next level with you, Father. We want to go to that uncomfortable place that will then become a comfortable place so that we can move on to the next uncomfortable place and continue to just free fall into the center of your love. That's what we want, Father. Help us to leave no stone unturned in our lives to get there with you and to find this abundant life that you have for us. Thank you for everything that you do every moment of our lives, Lord. We love because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.
Thanks.